dying, Father, is nothing less. Ever since I was a child, I have a feeling that something is missing in me. I want to know why I'm here. Can any of us know that? Become yourself. Let God and the devil don't mess. I want to learn. I want to understand. Become. Can you find the force to enable these two quite opposite lives to live together in your soul? At any moment, the wolf can devour the lamb. And you must learn what it means to become responsible. This is an exact lesson. And that is why you are here.
Tuning in, you can follow us regularly. We're coming to you three times per week, and every other week one of these programs is Radio 314 with Lana. RedIceCreations.com and RedIceMembers.com is our websites where you can find more. Writer, former journalist, artist and musician Ole Damegård is back on Red Ice Radio today to continue our series on the assassination of Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme and to talk more about his book Coup d'etat in Slow Motion. In previous programs, part 1 and 2, Ola has helped us to uncover the real facts behind the assassination and similarities to other assassinations like JFK, and also how it connects to events like the Iran-Contra affair. Today we're going to talk about the paperwork associated with the consequent cover-up. We put focus on the autopsy report and the strange suicide of the doctor Milan Valerius, who signed Palme's death certificate. We further discuss the discrepancies in the police timesheets and the radio communication. The testimony of the first police inspector on site, Gösta Söderström, whom Ulla interviewed many times for his book, clashes with how the events are said to have unfolded, and this is key to understanding that something is wrong with the official story. All right, welcome back, Ulla. Good to talk to you again. Thank you for coming on. I hope everything is good with you today.
It's great. Thank you.
Excellent. So we are going to continue our series with you today on the assassination of Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme. And we have some fascinating things we want to go through in the second hour pertaining to the Estonia catastrophe, the sinking pretty much of the commercial vessel in the Baltic Sea. But we're going to save that for the second. And we have some things we want to get to that we haven't touched upon in the previous episodes. And I know that you wanted to do a brief, a very, very brief summary here in the beginning, so we kind of bring people up to speed, Ola, and also kind of go through some of the basics here before we dive into the additional data. So let's just do a brief summary, if we can, here, then.
Okay, so what we've been going through up till now is like you got the official version where the Prime Minister and his wife were on their way home from the cinema and an unknown man came up behind them, shot him dead in the street of Stockholm, then ran off and nobody ever saw him again. An alcoholic named Christer Pettersson has been sentenced for the killing and then later released. Now he's dead under strange circumstances. That's the official version, that he was the one, an alcoholic who, for some unknown reason, just was crazy and shot him dead. Then what we've been going through in the two first chapters here is that I've tried to present as much information as possible about the different international assassins that were on site this evening. A hit team consisting of very professional people from different countries, different groups with very different backgrounds, but all of them connected, most probably through the Stay Behind network. And all of these were gathered in Stockholm that night, backed up by some Swedish police men that were connected to the Stay Behind movement as well, right-wing extremists, that provided them with housing, weapons, logistics like cars and so on. And the whole thing backed up with a prepared investigation that was on standby, their own investigation, where its main task was to cover the whole thing up, to get all the normal, honest policemen out of the way, and so they could move into action and then take over the whole thing. This is what has happened, and this is what has been going on for all of these years, that nothing real has come out, at least not from official sources. It's only been a handful of very, very skilled journalists and private people who have just been continuously trying to dig up the real truth behind this.
And how easy is that, Ulla, considering, you've been researching this for many years now. There are loads and loads of documents and paperwork on this. There are huge amounts of articles, but most of it is tucked away, if I can put it that way, and it's not easy accessible. How have you found to just research this overall? Has it been really, really difficult, or is there a lot of easy accessible material out there that just simply no one is talking about?
It's been very, very hard, at least before the internet became so active or so built out as it is today. In the early days, I mean, this assassination happened in February 1986, and in those days it was very, very hard to get any kind of information out, because in Sweden they have like a censorship, but it's called that. It's while the case is still active, you are not allowed to get access to the documents. This means that for a person from the outside, it's very, very difficult to get inside and find out stuff. You have to go your own ways. You have to look up the witnesses yourself. And that is what I did. I went to Stockholm and just started digging into it from all different angles. And it turned out to be many, 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 many years of very hard work and thousands of hours in looking for documents, tracking down secret agents and witnesses and police, interviewing policemen and so on. So it has not been easy at all.
Have you talked with many of the eyewitnesses yourself, Ulla, and also have a lot of the police that you've been talking with been fairly open to discuss this with you?
It's very different from person to person, because as the people who have known about some of the details in here, we're talking about that it's in many, many different layers, and even the people that were involved in the shooting itself did not know the whole picture. It's always what they call the need-to-know chain. You only know your exact task, nothing else, so that you can't grasp on anyone else and so on. And many people who have been in the center of this have also been very scared, so it's been very hard to get information.
So what do you think we've been missing out on so far when it comes to a lot of the paperwork, Ulla? I know you've talked about some of the things that we've basically missed out. It comes to the autopsy report, to the death certificate. There's been interesting trails to all this when it comes to how the police handled everything, basically falsified documents. Let's go into the document world of all of this, if you will, and begin wherever you want to begin, Ulla.
No, we can. It's like when you start looking into this, I mean, if this had been a normal case, paperwork and details in the documents would be very accurate. There would be no problems. There could be mistakes, but they would not be very intentional, and they could be explained away. But in this case, since the documents have not been easy accessible, then other journalists and normal people like me have been forced to through legal means and other ways, force them to give out these documents. And after years of trying this, when we finally receive them, then when we look at them, we just find that, oh my God, what is this? It's sort of like unreal, because we're talking about the assassination of the Swedish Prime Minister, not just any kind of car theft or something like that. So these are really important and very historical documents. And for instance, like if you had the death certificate of Olof Palme, once again, we're talking about the Prime Minister of Sweden here, the name and date and all of these things are correct, but the address, his own address, is Storkyrkobrinken 31, Stockholm. This is an address that doesn't exist. This street, Storkyrkobrinken, does not have 31 numbers. Okay?
What does that mean?
What it means is that this death certificate was written by the coroner, Milan Valverius, who later committed suicide together with his wife. Both of them died at the same time. And he also was the one that that led the whole autopsy of Olof Palme. And it took, I think it took about 8 years to get these documents released so that we could have a look at them. And when we got them, there's about 8 pages of where you can follow the whole autopsy and the description of the body and so on. But almost 50% of it is blacked out.
Yeah.
It's big black areas. Why? We're talking about a homicide where he's officially shot with one shot right through the body. Boom, that's it, dead. Story over. But here, it's very apparent that something has been covered up big time.
Let's clarify this a little bit more for our foreign audience, if you will, here, Ola. Is there a similar, as the Americans have Freedom of Information Act, is there a similar thing in Sweden, and is this how you got the documents? Because we know from those cases as well, there's tremendous amounts of blacked out material in those as well. Are we talking about a similar kind of thing here?
We're talking about a very similar type of thing, yes.
So there is a Freedom of Information Act in Sweden, and this is how you attain the documents, and you say a lot of the basics here are blacked out. And so what's your guess on what's contained therein? Why is it blacked out?
This is a very, very good question. And the coroner, Milan Valverius, kept saying that the truth about the assassination of Olof Palme is in this document. It is hidden in this document. And I've spoken to many different doctors and so on who looked at it, and I've come to a conclusion that I would very much go back to in the next and final chapter of this whole investigation, because it's pointing to a thing that is on a totally different level. And what I would like to, in the next program, just to round the whole thing up with, because it's an absolute scandal on the highest level. There's several people on very high positions that right after the assassination, like the ambassador Carl Lidbom, who was one of the advisors for Olof Palme and who is very central in this whole drama, he said on a very early stage that the very best thing for everyone involved in the assassination is that it would never be revealed, that it was would never be solved, this problem. To be able to say a thing like that, you need to know the truth behind it. And also Hans Holmér, who was the chief investigator of the whole thing for the first years, he said that if the real truth ever came out about this assassination, it would shake Sweden in its foundation.
Yeah.
What would shake Sweden in its foundation? Would it be that an ordinary drunk had shot down the prime minister? No. Would it be that it was like a local group of policemen that shot Olof Palme? Would that shake Sweden in its foundation? Nope. We're talking about a massive, massive thing that they're trying to cover up here. And that is what I will hopefully be able to show here, or I am able to show in these programs.
All right, interesting. More to come on that then. Milan Valverius, the doctor you said, he committed suicide, or was he suicided, Ola?
It's a difficult question to answer. He was, after he went out on TV and talked about these things, he was put through a lot of difficult times on his job. He was what they called frozen out. His colleagues didn't want to talk to him, and also he was when he went sick, he got cancer, and he had to leave his job for a while. Then when he got back, all his notes had disappeared, and he was put off the whole case. And in the end, he was put on a lot of stress. They accused him in the newspapers of different things where he had not done his job the way he should. So he was under tremendous pressure there for a while. And they say that this got his cancer going very fast. And then his wife, Sonia Valderius, and him decided to commit suicide the very same day. So it was a double suicide.
When you
look at similar cases, these suicides it's very often not a real suicide, but like you said, that they have been suicided.
Yeah. All right. Interesting. So, the doctor, what else can you say about the autopsy report and how it's been covered up? Was it other people involved in making this inaccessible or something like that?
Yeah, it's been. There's been a lot of strange things around this autopsy protocol, and also, like we've been touching on before, that the involvement of the Palmer family has been very, very strange throughout this whole case. Lisbeth Palmer, for instance, has been appearing very, very odd and strange, and the whole way that the investigation has avoided pushing or pressuring her in any way have been very strange, to say the least. For instance, to start with, just after the assassination itself, she said to the police that she hadn't seen the killer himself. She thought it was two people. And she didn't see a face, she just saw him run off. And not like a clumsy elephant, which is the official story now, but she saw him run off quite fast. Anyway, then a little while later, the investigators, the investigation that was sort of put in place to cover the whole thing up, they went home and had a long, long what they call interview with Lisbeth Palmer. And after that, suddenly she started remembering exactly what he looked like and gave a very detailed description of his face and all of these things.
And let me guess, that description was a perfect match to Krister Pettersson, correct?
No.
No? Okay.
Krister Pettersson came later.
Okay.
He came about 2 years later. But if we come and start talking about Krister Pettersson, the same people, more or less, that had been there talking to her at that time, when Krister Pettersson was taken and put in custody, they prepared her before making a confrontation with him, and they said that now they got him. They said he's a 40-year-old alcoholic from Sollentuna and so on. So her first words when she saw the lineup was, well, it's very easy to see who's the alcoholic. Yeah. Mm. This whole case has been used like a super example of how not to conduct an investigation and a lineup thing. It's been used in different police schools internationally. Because also he was lined up with a stripy sweater, I mean, and white shoes, and, you know, he looked a bit, alcoholic. The other people were mostly police officers and nicely dressed and so, and they put him on some of these lineups that he was right in the center. Mm-hmm. So, your eyes go straight to him right away. Anyway, during the trial against him, she said, I don't want the press to be here. She didn't allow anyone to be there from the press, or she didn't allow any tape recordings, sound recordings, or filmings, anything like that. So the press had to be seated in a room next to the courtroom, and there was a sound there were loudspeakers, so the press could hear what was going on, but the sound was delayed so that anything that was said there that they didn't want to get out there could be stopped. I mean, it's a total scandal, and the international press was just like in chaos. You'd say, what is going on? Also, like with Lisbeth Palme and several of the different witnesses, when they did a reconstruction of the crime on the site, you know, where they take witnesses and they set up the whole thing again, mm-hmm. so they can see what actually happened.
Yeah,
she was not there, and many of the other witnesses, where the reconstruction was built on what they had been saying, they were not there. They were not allowed to be there.
Hmm.
When it comes to this autopsy, as well, one of the doctors that was there. Her name is Kari Ulmstad. She happened to say things about this autopsy that made the son of Olof Palme, Joakim Palme, trying to sue her because she had gone out and publicly talking about this autopsy.
Hmm.
So you tell me, what there's something very strange here. And one of the things that is strange is that when Olof Palme arrived to the hospital in the ambulance, for one thing, the ambulance, there were officially two ambulances on site there, but witnesses have only seen one, but there were two ambulances, and Lisbeth Palme came together with the body of her husband in the first ambulance. They, for some reason, they took a detour. So they were delayed for about 5 minutes. They came about 5 minutes too late to the hospital. And when they got there, she was not dressed in the same coat anymore that she was officially she was shot at. And there was a bullet that passed right through her clothes. But the clothes that are put forward as evidence are not the same clothes that you see on the pictures when she runs into the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
It just goes on and on like that all the time around the Palme family. There's also a very strange thing about his son, Morten, that were together with Olof Palme and Lisbeth this evening when they went to the cinema. Officially, they parted just outside the cinema, and Olof and Lisbeth decided to walk home, and that was just a few minutes later that he was shot down. But Morten and his girlfriend walked home to the girlfriend's apartment, they said, and took a tea there. And then Lisbeth called from the hospital saying, please, your dad has been shot. Please come here. But what happened was that the timing, when you compare these, the times from when Lisbeth could have called and when they were in the apartment, it doesn't fit, it doesn't add up. He was not there when she could have made the phone call. But when instead he was observed, instead of going straight to the hospital, he went to the apartment of Olof Palme in the old town of Stockholm. And the neighbor there, who he used to have the keys because he used to go in and water the plants when the Palme couple was not at home or abroad or something like that. So Morten Palme came and knocked on the door of the neighbor and said, please, please, give me your key. And he went in there, in the apartment, and he was about in there for about 20, 25 minutes or something like that, looking for something. Then he came out and was picked up by a police car and driven off to the hospital. Huh. And later he said that, well, it was like, I thought that when my mom called and said that my dad had been shot, I misunderstood, and I thought they took him home.
Yeah, it's very, very strange. Very, very strange around the family. I mean, I agree with you. Lisbeth Palme, she is 82 years old right now. Her birthday was actually just a few days ago, March 14th, 314, by the way. She might not live too much longer. She has, she might, you know, be in a position where she might speak out if this is what she wants. But that's the question, if she wants to talk about this, because there could be, you know, for reasons that you mentioned, that this the scandal around this is just simply too big. She just wants to be part of of the cover-up to a certain degree. But as far as you know, Ulla, has she ever spoken, you know, consequently after this in any greater detail about the assassination? And furthermore, do you think she ever will, like, speak out, a kind of a deathbed confession or something like that? What do you think?
I don't know. It depends on how much we can get out about this in different ways. For sure, she has not done anything to help solve this problem or this crime at all. On the contrary, she's done everything to stop people from finding out what actually happened. There's more mystery things around this Palme family. The youngest son, Matthias Palme, he was officially in the south of France in Chamonix on a ski holiday when this happened. And when when Olaf Palme was shot, then Carl Lidbom, that I mentioned before, and Ebbe Carlsson, that we have also been talking about, a very, very strange figure in all of this, who was, in my opinion, connected directly with Stay Behind. They decided together with Ingvar Carlsson, that was the vice prime minister, that they wanted to get Matthias home. He was about, I think he was 17 at the time. So they wanted to get hold of him and fly him home as soon as possible. This is the official story. Mm-hmm. So to do that, Ebbe Carlsson managed to get the French prime minister to supply them with a jet plane, a private jet, and fly from, come to Sweden, pick up Carl Lidbom and Ebbe Carlsson, then fly them to France and land in Chamonix that doesn't have an airport, and from there go to the hotel and pick up Matthias Palme. Nobody saw them there. Then take him, and somehow it's very, there's the time doesn't match up at all. So there's three, four different versions how they brought him back to Sweden, because on one, first they said that they took him, I think they took him on one of the ordinary flights home, but that didn't match up. So after that, also when it was found out that there was no airport in Chamonix, then they said, no, we went to Geneva, and then we went in a car to pick him up. When that didn't match up either, because other people had seen, a witness that had seen other people come and pick up Matthias, then the story was changed again. And the whole thing is that if he had just been put on a normal airplane, he could have gone home in a few hours. But instead, it took him, I think it was until the next day in the afternoon that he came home. And both Carl Lidbom and Ebbe Carlsson, who are very central in this whole drama, nobody had seen them until, I think it was the 2nd of March, like 2 or 3 days later. And we're talking about the ambassador, the Swedish ambassador in France, in Paris at the time. So people came from everywhere, you know, to show their condolences and these, but the ambassador wasn't there.
So
what
they
have been, and this is what I'm going to come back to in the final chapter, because they're very much involved in what I believe really happened, the real motive behind this whole thing. But also Matthias Palme was approached by, I think it was a West German TV team that asked him, please, could you tell us what happened? How did you get back to Sweden? Yeah. And he told them that, I'm sorry, but I'm not mentally strong enough to be able to answer that question.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean? Mentally strong enough to answer a simple question about how you got back from? Do you say, there's something very strange here.
Hmm. Do you think that the family had been threatened as part of the whole assassination in some way?
I think that, like I said, if we can get back to that in the final chapter, because that's going to be totally around this whole thing. What was the reason behind this?
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's do that.
It's very complicated, so if I go in that direction, it's going to get quite confused.
Okay, no worries. So back to the autopsy report and see if there's anything else to mention about that, Ulla, before we proceed.
if I can go to the police protocols instead from this evening, you know, like there was a big problem this evening because the time of the shooting, the official time of the shooting, does not match up with what witnesses saw, and the whole time scheme is wrong. There's about 6 minutes that differs from when Gösta Söderström, the police commissioner, he was the first police on site that evening. When he came there, a man ran up to the police car and said, "There's been a shooting on Sveavägen." So they went straight away in the car up there, and on the way, like he always did, he wrote down the time because that is standard procedure. So he wrote the time 23:28 and on a note block, and then when they came to the assassination site, he took care of the victim. He had no idea that it was Olof Palme at that time. He took care of the victim, saw that he was dead, got the whole police chase organized, and so on. But when he came back that night and reported the time, his colleagues or the guy above him, and he said, no, it's not 23:28, it's 23:23 that it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, no, absolutely not. So they checked the watches and everything, if they were synchronized, him and his driver. They weren't, but they found out that Gösta Söderström's watch was all right. Anyway, why is this important? It is important because officially, when you put the times together, there are two or three police cars with right-wing policemen that was later very much involved, which we have been talking about before. They came to the site minutes before, about 6 minutes before the alert went out. You see, we have a problem here. How could they know that the shooting had occurred before the alarm even went out? And this is why these 6 minutes around the shooting itself is of extreme importance. And that is also why Gösta Söderström got his whole life destroyed. Really, he died a few years ago as a very lonely, lonely man that had just been doing his job, a very, very honest man and strong man to be able to stand up against the pressure that the police force and other forces put on him.
Yeah.
But if you look at the protocol from the police own protocol for this evening, you see that there's very strange things happening here because they're not very good at these things. This is what is good for an investigator like myself, but they're very clumsy. For instance, like the protocol from this evening, they got the date is right, but the day is wrong. They say Saturday the 28th. And on the time 23:23, there are 14 different vehicles at the site.
Hmm.
That is the official story. When Gösta Söderström arrived there, there should be 13 other vehicles at the same time.
Wow.
And then when you look at the radio communication, you know, with this, all of this is recorded automatically. And in the background, you have what we call Fröken Ur. I don't know the English term, but like a female voice that says 23:20.
The clock announcer, you can call up basically and check
the
time. Yeah.
And this, these tapes, when asked to get them out, there was a lot of problems getting them released. And when they were released, there were lots of different parts missing. And also, you can on that specific time, there were two different tape recorders with this voice, tape recorder A and tape recorder B, saying exactly the same. But the B version was like, if there was any problem with the A tape recorder, then the B would automatically come in.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a technical sound engineer that listened to these tapes very, very carefully in big detail. And he found out that the tape recorder B, that was used this night had a slight click sound every time it said a certain number. Do you know, like 23 and 10?
Mm-hmm.
And the tape recorder A did not have this. But on the tapes that are officially the true ones, you can hear exactly, like, on some of it, there's no click sound, and on some of it, there are click sounds. So they're manipulated, and also many of the parts of the communication is just gone. It's not just not there.
Why this time discrepancy then? Why someone has gone in there, obviously edited the tapes in some way, or cut it right there to make it match up or fit, obviously. Do you believe that this is done like years later, or
no,
this,
no, right no, away.
Right away, okay.
Right away. Because if it had not been for Gösta Söderström that stood up and said, no, I swear I came here at that time, 23, 28, had he been a weaker person, he would just have said, I'm sorry because I made a mistake. Then they would have gotten away with this. Because these vehicles knew they were part of the assassination. They did not come there after the alarm went out, the alert went out. So these are direct proof that the police were involved.
This is like a Building 7, sorry, Ulla. This is like a Building 7 and the BBC kind of thing. They're reporting on it before it actually has happened, pretty much.
There you go. And this is the whole thing. It's the whole case in a nutshell. If you tell the truth, it's very simple. It's direct. You don't have to do any explanation. The truth is the truth. When you start lying, and the more people involved in a big lie like this, it gets very messy, and it's impossible to keep. It just gets everybody. Everything gets entangled, and people start lying, and people, you know. So this is one of the things that occurs.
Did you you talked with Gösta Söderström yourself at a few occasions? Is that correct?
Yeah. I became a very close friend of his.
Yeah. Well, what else can you say about him and his thoughts on around all of this?
He in my book Coup d'etat in slow motion, he has written the foreword, and where he recommends my book. Thank you very much. But he was an amazing man, because he was one of the few people that dared to stand up against this whole machine, because they were very, very upset with him, and that he was told that right away as well. When he just a few days after the assassination, he was looked up by his commander in chief, and he said, "You have no idea what you've done," because Gösta Söderström went out in the press saying something is totally wrong. They are messing up the times here. This is not correct. Because officially they said that to cover up these 6 minutes, they said that Gösta Söderström had been so shocked finding out that it was the Prime Minister, that he had been walking around like a zombie for 6 minutes doing nothing, in total shock. And Gösta said to me, "Come on, I had been in active duty for more than 30 years. I've seen burned babies. I've seen homicides, I've seen whatever. I didn't even know it was all of Parliament. Why would I turn into a zombie just like that? This was just another day."
Yeah. Wow. And he was of the... I was reading a little bit about him as well. He's kind of like the old school kind of police guard up in Stockholm at the time. He's like been on duty for many, many years. A trusted, commissionary, I think he was, if that's the correct translation, police commissionary. I wouldn't doubt his testimony. Why would he make something like this up that would just, as you said, kind of further complicate the whole scenario, you know?
No, God, no. It took his whole career went down the drain, and he had nothing to gain for him in this. It was just that he was a man of honor, big time, and that was what became his downfall. But also, I salute him, like they say, big time. Also, one of his colleagues, his name was Gösta Trysberg, or Gustav, where he was called Gösta. They were old friends. And he used to be one of the senior officers in Norrmalms police station, where we had this gathering of very right-wing police, very violent right-wing policemen. Also, this infamous so-called baseball gang that kept beating people up and even killing people. And a few years before the assassination of Olof Palme, this Gösta Trysberg was very, very worried that the people under his command were Nazis, straightforward Nazis. We're talking about Hitler salutes, and they had private meetings in the police station where nobody was allowed in. And he tried to stop this in all the different ways he could. And in the end, he was discredited. They took away his license and his gun and all of these things. And in the end, one day he was very paranoid. The last week or something like that, I spoke to his wife, and then one day he just went down to get the mail and didn't come back. And when they went out, they found him, and officially to this day, he committed suicide by stabbing himself 15 times and then hitting himself in the face with something very hard.
Okay. Yeah.
15 times. You can't even imagine. It's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, and let's do it properly, 15. You can't even do that if you're trying, you know. And also the knife was found underneath his body.
Yeah.
And the guy, the coroner who signed this as a suicide, he is also one of the coroners that was part of the Olof Palme autopsy. His name is Jovan Reis, and he's a key figure in many of these big cases in Sweden, like the Styckmordsrättegången, the decapitated, there was a prostitute, Catherine Dacoste, that was found decapitated and chopped up in pieces. He's a guy that keeps popping up again and again, and well, I can only say that at least in this case, committing suicide by stabbing yourself 15 times, that is not correct.
It's an achievement, if nothing else. Wow, yeah, it's and it's kind of obvious to me as well, Ola, that different criminal gangs and groups with various political ideologies would try their very best to infiltrate the police and gain upper hand by getting, you know, as many of their people involved as possible. And I think we've seen this in many different parts of not only Swedish society, of course. I think it's happening around the world, but they go in and practically take over an organization, or at least a region, and they dominate, and the old guard, if you will, are pretty much thrown out. I mean, this has happened with political parties. It's happened with the police, I definitely think that that's something going on there for sure.
If you look at the key people within the police when it comes to this one, you have got Hans Holmér, and you've got Tommy Lindström. Tommy Lindström was the head of the CID, I think it's called, the Kriminalpolisen, Rikskriminalen. That's the national CID criminal investigation police. I'm not sure of the correct term. Anyway, we're talking about somebody on the absolute highest level of the police force when it comes to crimes in Sweden. So when a thing like this happened, the prime minister of a country is shot, you would think, just by normal logic, that these guys would get their act in gear and get to their job as soon as possible to start to get involved and solve the crime and get the murder. Is that too much to ask for? I think not.
Yeah, no.
Okay, so what did he do, Tommy Lindström, this morning? He's even written a book about his life as a cop. It's called Mitt Liv som Snut, My Life as a Cop. And he describes this morning exactly when Olof Palme was shot, because it was his birthday. So what did he do? At 5 o'clock in the morning, after the assassination, he went out. Nobody had called him. Okay, so he went out to the mailbox, and he gets the newspaper, and he sees, oh my God, the Swedish Prime Minister has been shot. So what does he do? Does he jump in the car? Does he call his office? No, he goes back to bed because it was his birthday, and he didn't want to spoil his kids' surprise because he knew they had a surprise waiting for him. So he stays in bed. He stays in bed, and then the kids come in with a cake and candles and all of this and singing for him, and then they give him an ice stick, a bandy club, whatever that is called, thing like that. Mm-hmm. And then at 11 o'clock he comes into to work. I ask you, is this believable? This is a guy who then turns up again and again and again, and he's to this day called in as an expert on TV. You see him again and again, mm-hmm. Making commentary on this. He's also the guy, he was later fired. And can I also mention that one of his informers, Milan Heidenreich, was one of the guys who offered 1 million to a very a very violent Swedish guy to do the hit on Olof Palme himself. This Milan Heidenreich, who was, like I say, an informer for Tommy Lindström, later died in a very mysterious car crash. This Tommy Lindström as well, he got fired in the end because there was too many scandals around him. But when the South African connection came up, if you remember, we were talking about that the
other time. Sure.
And this information came from a colonel, a South African colonel, called Eugene de Kock, also called Prime Evil. He was the guy who in the court, in the Truth and Reconciliation Court, just mentioned, he was talking about something else, and then he mentioned, well, anyway, they were also, one of my men were also part of the Palme assassination. This started the whole scandal unraveling. But Eugene de Kock said that he had the name of the killer, that it was a Kurdish guy living in Turkey. He was the real assassin, like also that I mentioned before, being part of a hit team of international hitmen under the organization and control by the super spy Craig Williamson, mm-hmm. the South African.
Right.
Yeah. So he had the name of the killer. Okay, so did the Swedish investigation go down there and say, hello, Mr. Eugene de Kock, could you please hand over the name? No, they did not. The Swedish media had to chase them for about, I can't remember, I think it was like 2 weeks or something like that, to go down there, do something. No, we're so focused on Christer Pettersson, we had to stay here, we can't just run around doing all kinds of things, we had to stick to what we got.
Yeah.
Anyway, in the end, they had to go down there, Hans Ölvedro and some other people. But before that, who came and visited Eugene de Kock in the high security prison in South Africa where no one was allowed in? Who was allowed in there without a proper ID because he had been fired? Tommy Lindström. And then when the investigation came down there and talked to Eugene de Kock, he said, no, I'm very sorry, I lost the note with the name. But he gave the name to Hans Ölvedro. No one has ever asked Hans Ölvedro about this, and he never mentioned it either, what the name of the assassin was. But when interviewed, Hans Ölvedro said that he was asked in the program Efterlyst, they asked him, so how was South Africa? Did you find out any interesting? And he said, yeah, the parks down there, the wildlife parks, they're really interesting, you know. And
nice.
Also, when you ask people who they interrogated in South Africa, they were asking about nightclubs and stuff like that.
Hmm.
You know, they were not interested at all to find out anything about what had actually happened.
So they know they know what's going on. They've already settled that this is not going to be investigated any further, and for the circus of, you know, for the media, for that whole circus, they play the charade and try to at least act to a certain extent that they're interested in this. So they go down there, but when they get there, there's no proper investigations, no real questions are asked. But this guy then, Tommy Lindström, he has to have Well, he's got to be connected with the network pretty well then to be let into the prisons and stuff like that. I mean, he has to have a lot of connections.
A lot of connections, I would say. Very high. And I think we're back to this connection with Stay Behind, drug cartels, all of these things. On he's also involved in the in an art theft in Stockholm that was very strange as well, where there were some art pieces stolen and then returned. Tommy Lindström came out as a hero because he managed to pay off the thieves and get the paintings back. But the people involved, the security guy of the museum who was earlier on working at Skandia, together with Tommy Lindström, these guys, we're talking about, in my opinion, charades again.
Yeah.
Charades, but on a big level.
Yeah.
Can I just say, the way that, if we go back to the night of the assassination itself, the way they get rid of normal people, the honest, good investigators, because I'm absolutely not pointing out and saying the police are bad or something, but we're talking elements here that are criminal elements, yeah?
Yep, got it.
There was one, his name was Arne Irwell. He was the chief of the murder commission in Sweden. He was called any homicide in Stockholm and sometimes in the whole of Sweden, if it was complicated, he was called out right away, standard procedure. How did he find out of the assassination? He was sat at his breakfast table, 7 o'clock in the morning, reading the newspaper, and he saw it, and he said, oh my God, what happened? So he calls into the office and saying, why haven't you called me? Why haven't anyone told me about this? And they said, well, we knew that this is going to be a very long investigation, so we thought the best thing was for you would be to have a really long sleep in so that you come really fresh and prepared.
Yeah.
Okay. So he came into his office, and what did they do? They put him to answer the telephones and speak to the press.
Mm.
Can you see? We're talking about, it's ridiculous. It is absolutely ridiculous if you see it from a point where if there was actually an investigation that was trying to find out the truth, then it would be ridiculous what's happening.
So it's with the, well, if you will, then bureaucracy, really, paperwork and assigning various people who could, you know, who are talented and designated within the country, within the regions to handle these kinds of cases, to put them on stupid tasks and mundane,
yeah.
You know, operations basically, while they would, because these boys would probably stumble on to what really is going on in the network, and I do believe that some people have, and they've been picked off one by one, because it's curious as well, as you brought up now in many of the episodes we've done, Ulla, how many people consequently are just picked off. They're assassinated, a car crash here, it's, you know, they die of cancer, something like that. It's one by one, it's kind of taken out.
Yeah, true. Let me get back to Hans Holmér.
Sure.
Hans Holmér and Ebbe Carlsson. Ebbe Carlsson was this guy who was officially just a book publisher, but the way he's acting and with his connection, my strong conviction is that he was working directly for Stay Behind and directly under the headquarters in Brussels, but in Sweden, because this guy could just go in. He, in this case with Olof Palme, he ordered around the prime ministers. He called up a foreign prime minister and told them what to do. When the embassy, do you remember the West German embassy in Stockholm was occupied
mm-hmm.
by terrorists? Who came in? He was only 27. This guy came and just started ordering around everybody, and everybody was standing in line just saying, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir. Explain that to me if you can, if you're just an ordinary book publishing guy.
Hmm.
Anyway, he and Hans Holmér were buddies for quite a few years. They were also the ones that, when there was a big scandal in Gothenburg about we call it the hospital scandal, Sjukhusskandalen in Gothenburg, where it turned out that there had been... they recorded people employed at the hospital and registered their political views and all of these things. Then Hans Holmér and Ebbe Carlsson went in and cleared it up. also at the Bordel Hervan, you know, the where there was another scandal, I think it was 82, 4 years before the assassination, there was a scandal about that about 200 politicians and people way up in the power pyramid, that they were involved with prostitutes and underage.
Minors, yeah.
Minors, exactly.
Lennart Jayer, some of the other people involved in this as well. We talked about that briefly as well, I think, one of the programs.
Yeah, we did. Yeah. But the thing was, this list of with all the names disappeared. And where did it disappear from? It disappeared from Hans-Holmér's safe. Okay?
Mm.
I don't think it disappeared at all. I think that everybody on that list from that day on were totally in their power.
Exactly.
And this is also why this conspiracy of silence that we keep bumping into. Because if you look at just the things we've been talking about today, if somebody has manipulated this evidence, we're talking about somebody who have to have access to these tape recordings, to have access to the original protocols, to have access to communication tapes, all of these things. Then we're talking about a police connection. The DAs and all of these other lawyers that are involved, that are proof of this, do not react to it. Then we're talking about a connection on that level, and the politician not saying anything. Then we're talking about a connection with politicians, and so it just goes up and up and up because no one is reacting.
Well, what it looks like as well, and potentially, Ulle, is that this doesn't necessarily mean that you have everyone up in the higher levels, if you will, of police, of politics involved. It's simply that someone is in a position where they can blackmail these people who have been involved in something like this, the Bordel, you know, scandal or something like that, that they've been caught with minors, as we talked about this before as well, they've been taped or something like that, and they have something that they can use against them, blackmail. So whenever the time is due for them to perform a task for this information not to leak out, that's when they're put to work, if you know what I mean. So this is how they potentially then get access to certain documents, by blackmailing the people who have the power to be there at those times, to eradicate it, to make it disappear, edit it, what have you. This is potential how it might look here. And the question we go back to again then is, of course, all right, who is really doing the blackmailing? Who is, you know, who's pulling the strings on any kind of level here?
I think you're spot on there. I think this is exactly what happened, because very, very, very few people know what actually happened that night. But they don't, you know, if you have all this information that you can blackmail people about, that will just make them stand in line and shut up, which is the whole point of it. And this is what I think happened. Exactly. With this and many, many other scandals as well.
That's right. And it ultimately means as well that they're still, even if they're not involved and on those levels, they're still unfit to rule, as so many are, because they are part of these, you know, activities of you know, sex with prostitutes and minors and everything else, and they're being used as such. So they're not fit to rule in any regard at all. So it doesn't. Clear them of any guilt in this situation at all.
I think we're talking about criminals. I mean, you're an accomplice of a crime if you know and you don't tell. You know, so
I agree. Now let's see if there's anything else you want to squeeze in here, Ulle, in the last few minutes we have in the first segments before we move on to the second and tie in Estonia into all of this as well. Something we've left out? What do you think?
Yeah, I would like to just run a little around Hans-Holmér. Hans-Holmér was the länspolismästare. He was like the local police chief for Stockholm. And he used to be the chief of the security police of Sweden, Säpo. But he had never, ever done an investigation of a homicide. So he was not at all the right person to lead an investigation like this. Officially, he went up to Borlänge to take part of the Vasaloppet, the big ski, what do you call it, ski contest. What would you call that?
Yeah, what would you call that? It's like
a massive sport event where there's thousands of people going 30 kilometers on ski.
That's right.
And that is where he was officially. And you can read his book as well. He writes that at 7 o'clock in the morning, he gets a phone call and they say, oh my God, Olof Palme has been shot, you need to come down here. So he takes his car, he was up there with his mistress, he takes his car and he drives back as fast as he can to Stockholm, and then he comes in around, I think, 11, comes in and just takes over right away, takes over the whole investigation with no one asking, who are you, why are you doing this, and nobody could say anything. He just took over and started leading this whole investigation that was just leading absolutely nowhere. After a few years, there was more and more question marks coming up around this guy, and especially a journalist called Sven Anér was tracking him down, trying to see why are all these inconsequences, why are the, it seems like there's lies going around this guy. So he tracked him down and tracked down the hotel where he was supposed to have stayed. They had never heard of him, and after a while, when he kept pushing, asking for documents, and he kept asking Hans Holmér to answer, where were you this night? He even did it on TV saying, come on, you show yourself and this, and I'm ready here, I will... Anyway, when he kept pushing for this, Sven Anér, in the end, they gave out some documents showing that he had actually stayed overnight there. When you look at these, we're back again. It's the wrong dates. It's signed by with a signature that is the wrong signature of the people who worked there. It's it's just the false, these documents that shows that is supposed to show that he was actually staying at that hotel. But why is this important? This is important because the driver of Hans Holmér, he was a policeman, a former paratrooper and very skilled policeman. He was his private driver this evening. And he came out a few years after the assassination saying that he had driven Hans Holmér just passing the site of the assassination 7 minutes after it happened. Now we're talking about him officially being several hundred kilometers away in Borlänge, and here his driver is saying that he drove him past the site of the assassination. He said that he had been driving Hans Holmér around that evening. He also had been collecting somebody earlier this afternoon, somebody he called the ambassador. Let me just go back and say the ambassador in Paris at this time, and one of the key people, as far as I understand, his name was Carl Lidbom. So it might very well be that the ambassador was Carl Lidbom that he was driving around. But anyway, when they passed the site of the assassination, there were people there, and I don't know if the ambulance had just left, and the driver said, should I stop? And Holmér just said, no, just keep on. So they passed it, and later that night also they picked up a woman and with a fur coat. If you go back again, there was this problem with the fur coat with Lisbeth Palme that was put forward as evidence with bullet holes in it, not being the same fur coat as on the photos when she runs into the hospital. So, and this Hans Holmér, he keeps coming up in very strange circumstances as well. And as we will take in the last final chapter, also he keeps coming up in strange things on that level as well.
Hmm. All right. Well, very good. Hey, by the way, Ulla, do you have any plans to, like, you know, doing talks or anything like that, or traveling around, you know, discussing this? I bet there's a lot of people who want to, you know, learn more about this, of course.
I tell you, the response after these interviews has been absolutely amazing. It's been like a tidal wave of interest. It's, for me, it's been absolutely wonderful after all of these years where people have looked upon me being like a bit of a nutcase. And now it's like the time is so ready for this type of information. And I've had a lot of emails, especially from the States, asking. And I just wanted to say, if there's any interest of me coming to the States, I would be very, very happy to come there, or other countries, whatever. So if anybody could arrange a tour or send me emails with requests, I will be very happy to put together like a trip, maybe a bit in a few months or something like that.
All right, good. You have your email, of course, on the website, so people can contact you there, correct?
Yeah, it's info@oledamegaard.com or damegaard.com.
All right, we will link up the email, if you don't mind, then, Ole, so people can contact you through that.
That's very kind of you, thank you.
As we usually like to do at the end of the first segment, tell us how to get your website, how people can get a copy of the book that we've been talking about here throughout the series, Coup d'etat in slow motion, and how people can support your work as well, Ole.
Well, my website is murderofparlament.com, murderofparlament.com, or my name, oledamegaard.com. And you can download it there for free. It's more than 800 pages filled with all of this information. It's not my point, my personal point of view coming across. I'm presenting a massive jigsaw, connecting the dots, and just showing it so that hopefully a reader can make up his own mind and see what makes sense and so on. And there is also, like Henrik said, there is a donation button, and I would be extremely grateful for donations, because this has been many, many, many years of very hard work and years that I've had very little income because I've been so devoted to this.
All right, very good. We encourage everyone to support Ole and, of course, get a copy of the book and read more, get into this. It's an incredible story, of course, that connects with so many other things, and this is what we're going to begin to focus on in the next segment as well, hour two here, of how it connects. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I just wanted to say it's both there in Swedish and English. And also, please understand that in this world of conspiracies, there are many, many different views of what actually happened. I know very few people that agree with me on these things that I'm presenting, but this is after, I think, I can't remember how many years it is, but this is, I've done my utmost to come up with as precise information as possible and pinpoint everything. So this is the picture I present, but like I said before, don't just swallow it without being critical. Read it and make up your own mind, and if it makes sense to you, then spread it.
Very good. Murderofpalme.com or oledamegaard.com. We'll have the links up there. Okay, we'll tune into a tune right here. So stay with us. We'll be right back with more.
Can you help me? It's cold and I'm
hour, we'll spend strictly on the Estonia catastrophe, Europe's worst maritime disaster since World War II. 852 people died, and the wreck is to this day still on the ocean floor of the Baltic Sea. Ulla will tell us how the ship was sunk intentionally, and the military exercises that was ongoing that day, and the military equipment that was transported by the ship. Finally, he'll detail how it connects to the assassination of Palme. We will continue on redicemembers.com. You can sign up for a subscription to continue to listen. We have many, many more programs for you archived on our members' website, together with a lot of other material. If you haven't tried it out before, we encourage you to do so. Sign up for a 3-month subscription and give yourself a gift of knowledge and ideas. Next on Red Ice Radio, we have Scott Bartle from Australia about his documentary What the Fook? Frequently Unanswered Questions of the Australian Government. After this, we have Rudy Matsoki about his time working in a genetics lab. He wrote a book in fiction format that are based on real events, among other things, a new method of abortion that resulted in the pirating of intact human fetuses that became a supply of harvested organs that were grown like hydroponic vegetables to supply the multi-billion dollar black market of human organ transplants. More is coming soon, and you're welcome to tune in then. Right now, we'll proceed with Ulla Damegård, the second hour.